Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Most Americans know about the Battle of Bunker Hill as a pivotal clash in the Revolutionary War, but less is known about the merchants, farmers, and sailors outside Boston and the doctor who led them in rebellion. Author Nathaniel Philbrick reconstructs the months leading up to the war and uncovers the unlikely heroes behind one of the most important battles in our nation's history. His new book is titled Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. It will soon be made into a movie starring Ben Affleck. Nathaniel Philbrick joins me in the studio. I look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to have you here. You know, even before we went on the air, we've received a tweet and something on the website. The tweet says, "We seem to have forgotten that Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam are someone else's Bunker Hill." Would you agree with that?
Well, that's interesting. You know, it's dangerous to draw parallels from the past, but I have to say Bunker Hill was the battle with which America realized a rebellion was going to be something more than something that was happening in a city. It was going to become a war that would take over the entire country. And I think, you know, countries around the world are experiencing revolutions. And I think what we've tended to forget is how traumatic and violent a revolution is. And it wasn't all ideology. There was a lot of fear and terror and resolve involved in our own revolution.
Tell me why you decided to focus this book on Bunker Hill.
Yeah, Bunker Hill is the turning point. My real focus is Boston. If there's a hero in this book, it's the community of that city, and a city that began as the center of patriot defiance, and then it would be turned inside out by an army of occupation. The British soldiers would arrive, and Boston would be transformed, and it would then become a city under siege as patriot forces on the outside surrounded the city. And so Boston would go through this incredible two-year turnaround, and for me, that was the story I wanted to get at. What did a community experience amid a revolution that burst into this terrible war?
And the book goes into extraordinary detail. Talk a bit about your research.
Yeah, well, I've been working on this book for 3 years, but actually it goes back farther than that. I wrote a book, Mayflower, that ends with King Philip's War in 1676. And with that, I realized that I wanted to take the story to the next level. I wanted to go 100 years after that and see what happened, because I could see that there was some deep issues in the colonies that were expressed 100 years later with the revolution. And so for me, it was a three-year process of not only going into the archives, but exploring Boston today. It's changed beyond recognition, but there are buildings like the Old South Meeting, the Old State House that are still there. And a lot of my time was trying to reconstruct the topography of pre-revolutionary and revolutionary Boston.
And of course, Boston has been so much, sadly, in the news recently.
Yeah, it's been a terrible thing for the city. And for me, it's, you know, if one thing came through loud and clear in those 3 years of research is that resilience is a part of Boston. It's gone through amazing things in the past and come back. I think we're seeing that today. It's a tough town, and it's a town where things happen that have repercussions all over the country and, if not, the world.
But one thing is different from back then in 1775 and what happened recently, in that in 1775, you had kind of a divided population about those who wanted to remain loyal to the king and those who were patriots.
Absolutely. I think a lot of us come out of elementary school thinking it was the
everybody.
Right. It was the patriots versus the Brits.
Yeah.
And it didn't begin like that at all. Boston was a deeply divided city. Some people were what we would call patriots, that were pushing, and would become revolutionaries. Others, many of them merchants who had ties to London commercially, really valued that relationship and were loyal to the king. And then there was probably the largest group that really didn't know what they thought about all this and really just hope everything would blow over and life would remain the way it was. And so Boston at this time was a city divided, and often it would break out in terrible violence in the streets.
Really?
Yes, tar and feathering. My first chapter of my book, there is customs commissioner, John Malcolm, who angers some townsfolk, and it becomes this horrible, largely politically motivated expression of community anger.
And why does he anger then?
Well, he was a combustible personality. And one of the things you find out is, yes, there were ideological differences of politics, but it also came down to who you were related to, what your personality was like. And this was a guy who loved to taunt the other side, to push. And he pushed too far, and he found himself the victim of being tarred and feathered. And but he had a brother who was on the other side. And so this was a civil war in many ways. It was dividing families right down the middle.
I'm sure you are the person to ask. Talk about the process of tarring and feathering.
Well, this particular tarring feathering happened in January. It was probably one of the coldest days of the winter. And they dragged him from his house, stripped his clothes off him, and you would take a turpentine. It was tar, turpentine based, and heat it up until it would become this hot black sludge. Pour it on the naked flesh, effectively parboiling the skin, and then taking feathers and smearing the feathers on the person. And this was not designed to kill the person. It was designed to humiliate them.
But could they survive?
Well, Malcolm had this occur to him basically where the Boston Massacre had happened a couple of years before, right in the center of town. And then they put him in a cart and took him up and down the streets of Boston for a number of hours at night. He went, after hours of this, he was finally rolled out of the cart into his house. And by one description, the flesh came off his back in steaks. It was that gruesome. But after 6 years in bed, six weeks in bed, he would survive and actually take a bit of his tarred and feathered flesh in a box back to London with him to present to the king. And so, this was a guy who was one of a kind and a rabble-rouser in his own way. And you see these revolutions often, it becomes those kinds of personalities.
And that's come to just the first chapter. Your second chapter is titled Poor, Unhappy Boston.
Yes, because what happened was my book basically begins with the Tea Party and then this tar and feathering. And London had decided that Boston must pay for its sins. And so they shut down the port of Boston.
And what had Boston done that London decided it was going to pay for its sins?
Well, it had, there was a tea tax. They were decided to hurl boxes of tea, the famous Boston Tea Party, hurl the tea into the harbor.
That had come from London.
And there were certain tea consignees, all of them loyalists, who were given the right to sell this, what was cheap tea. And this infuriated the patriots. And so the tea was dumped in Boston Harbor rather than be delivered. And so the king and parliament reacted by instituting the Boston Port Act, which closed Boston as a harbor. And
really isolating Boston.
And sent some troops four regiment of soldiers in to occupy the city.
Four regiments would be how many troops?
Approaching 1,000, more than 1,000. And so they began to fill up Boston, and Boston became the city of occupation.
How long after the Tea Party did those troops arrive?
It happened relatively quickly. The Tea Party was in December of 1773, and by June of 1774, the soldiers were arriving. By that time, General Thomas Gage had come in and was instituted the new royal governor, so there was a military governor. And they had moved the general court, the legislative body, from Boston to Salem. And so that Boston was basically being stripped of its identity and its a way to make a life. And Bostonians were outraged by this, but not only Bostonians. All of American colonies saw this as an example of what might be in store for them. And so, as has happened so many times, Boston became an example for what would become the entire country.
And how did the news travel to the other colonies?
Well, by this time, Samuel Adams, who was really, in a way, the mastermind of much of what had happened in Boston, had created the Boston Committee of Correspondence. And it was really a brilliant ploy by which he created an independent communication network by which he could communicate with towns throughout Boston, throughout Massachusetts, and eventually the colonies.
Nathaniel Philbrick, historian, author of Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Welcome back. We have Nathaniel Philbrick with us. He won the National Book Award for his book, In the Heart of the Sea. He wrote Mayflower. That was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Now he's written Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And you write that even though Boston was, as you describe it, unhappy, the war for independence was not a sure thing.
No, in the beginning, independence really wasn't what they were talking about. In fact, even the staunch patriots regarded England as home. It was what they called it. What they were looking for was the way it had been before, what's been called salutary neglect, where they were allowed to pretty much do it as they had without taxation, doing it the way they were used to doing it. But now the British Empire was modernizing itself and expected the colonies to pay for the privilege of being part of the empire. And this became the issue. How would that happen? And what the patriots wanted was that their own legislatures be able to determine this kind of issue.
How did the Brits see the people in Boston as opposed, for example, to how they saw the people in Virginia?
Well, the Bostonians were regarded as rabble rousers. Went back to the Puritan days when they had gone over to worship on their own, and they had a reputation as fighters throughout the French and Indian War, and so they had this reputation for stirring up a storm. Began with the Stamp Act, the Boston Tea Party reaffirmed it, and so it was their judgment that Boston must learn to live within the rules of the empire. And so this brought the Boston Port Act, and after that the Massachusetts Government Act, which basically stripped Bostonians of their, and all of Massachusetts, of their, what they viewed as their treasured rights.
So tell us now about Thomas Gage, who was appointed by the Crown to be the governor of Massachusetts. What was he like, and how did he approach his position?
Well, yeah, I ended up having a lot of sympathy for Thomas Gage. He was put in what turned out to be an impossible situation.
He, like everyone, underestimated
the furor that had been unleashed by the Port Act and later the Government Act. And so it was his job to put the screws down. And what he began to realize is he didn't have enough troops. He could handle Boston, but there was Massachusetts. And there were 250 towns in Massachusetts, 300,000 people. And what quickly became apparent, the true radicals were out there in those country towns, as they were called. And so as the colony became more and more divided and the Patriots gained more and more of a following, Boston, this British-occupied city, became a city under siege with the militiamen, because every town in Massachusetts had its militia. This dated back to the Indian Wars of the previous century. So they had a tradition of taking up arms. And this meant that this was a place like, not like back in England, where the army could come in and pretty much be a force to be reckoned with by the local populace. In Massachusetts, this was a group of people who had the means to take arms against the regulars.
And think about the Second Amendment.
Yes, and this, it's part of our country's past, and it's a part of our country's present, and it's there
and comes right out of there.
Yeah, and this was because America, in Massachusetts, they had a tradition of literally defending hearth and home from attack, and it went back to 1620 when the Pilgrims arrived, and it was a part of the colony. And so if you look back at the revolution in Boston, this is, of course, a part of the mindset that brought this revolution around.
Yeah. There were some other very influential people that we may not necessarily know about. Talk about Dr. Joseph Warren.
Yeah, Dr. Joseph Warren really became the focus of my book. I think, most of us think of the Continental Congress, where John Hancock, John Adams, Samuel Adams were delivering eloquent speeches and eventually coming up with the Declaration of Independence. What I was focusing on was the on-the-ground revolution. And it was this Dr. Joseph Warren, just 33 years old, with these other leaders gone at Philadelphia, he took over what was basically happening in Massachusetts. He was young, charismatic, a wonderful speaker, and a great writer. And he had this ability to convince people what he wanted to do was what they wanted to do. And he had an element of swashbuckling dynamic activity that just was endearing. And so he was the one who gave Paul Revere the order to send out the alarm that the British were headed to Concord. He would become the president of the provincial Congress, and so that he was the one leading the government in the tense 60 days after Lexington and Concord. And then at the Battle of Bunker Hill, by that point, he had been appointed a major general. And he would tragically die on the last British charge in that battle. And there were some loyalists who made the claim, you never know if it's true or not, but that if Joseph Warren had not died, Washington would have been in obscurity, one said. And so he was a man of that stature, that he was mourned citizens of Massachusetts did not know how they would go on without him. And he's been pretty much lost to history.
And if you go to our website, drshow.org, you will see a picture of Joseph Warren dying in battle. Talk about the Battle of Bunker Hill, how it began, and how many people were involved.
Yeah, the Battle of Bunker Hill really began as a mistake. What the Americans were trying to do was to delay, if not stop altogether, a planned British assault on their army, which was stationed in Cambridge and Roxbury. And the hope was to build a fort, a earthen fort, on the Bunker Hill on the Charlestown Peninsula, just across the river from Boston, where the soldiers were stationed. But for reasons that no one to this day knows quite why, William Prescott, the colonel who was in charge, built his redoubt, this earthen fort, not on Bunker Hill, but on Breed's Hill, which was a half mile to the south, right in the figurative face of the British Army in Boston. And this meant that when dawn arrived and General Gage looked across and saw this fort, within a cannon shot of his men stationed in Boston, and he had to do something about it. And so with this fort so close, he decided he must attack. And so under General Howe, they would send over 2,000 British regulars to the southern tip of the Charlestown Peninsula, where they would march on this little redoubt on Breed's Hill. By this time, other soldiers, American soldiers, had come onto the peninsula to reinforce Prescott's men, and they extended the defenses across the peninsula, but it became the bloodiest battle of the entire Revolution.
So did the battle take place on Breed's Hill or on Bunker Hill?
I think it's kind of appropriate that this battle that began with a mistake is named for the wrong hill, because it occurred on Breed's Hill. And when you go to the Bunker Hill Monument today, it's a beautiful monument, very much like the Washington Monument. You can see there's a sign. This is Breed's Hill. It's confusing, and it's confusing because there was an element of confusion at the very beginning of the battle.
Now, tell me, is it true that there is going to be a film made of this book starring Ben Affleck?
I can't tell you for certain. Warner Brothers and Ben Affleck have purchased the option, and you know, you never know until it happens, but it's a very exciting possibility to contemplate.
And we have no idea what role Ben Affleck will play.
You know as much as I do at this point. For me, the Battle of Bunker Hill was highly cinematic. It occurred right across the Charles River from Boston. And so you had all of the roofs, steeples, cupolas of Boston crowded with people
watching
this battle occur. And it was a dramatic spectacle like none other. These, 2,000 redcoats going up this hill towards this little earthen redoubt. We'll never know for sure if William Prescott said, "Hold your fire till we see the whites of their eyes." But the moral equivalent of that was going on. And it was just a terrible, bloody battle. And the British would finally win. They would take the redoubt and flush the Patriots out of Charlestown Peninsula. But they lost casualties of 50%. William Howe, who led his troops in battle, said, "The success is too dearly bought." As Nathaniel Green, an American general from Rhode Island, would say, "If we could sell another hill to the Patriots, to the British for the price of Bunker Hill, we'd be happy to do it." It was. And so to add to the confusion, this battle was actually a British victory. However, it proved—
Because they lost so many men.
Because they lost so many men, they now realized that this rebellion was now a full-scale war, that they had bit off a lot more than they had hoped to chew back with the Boston Port Act. And in a way, everything changed with the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Tell me how it was that the Americans themselves— The Patriots lost only 115 men, whereas the Brits lost more than 1,000. How did that happen?
What the Patriots had managed to do was dig themselves in. And it began with William Prescott at night. He had a little over 1,000 men, and they spent the night digging furiously this redoubt, which was about 138 feet long. It was a quadrangle, no roof to it. And when dawn came, he realized that his fort was wide open to the British on his left. So he began building once again furiously, and by this time, cannonballs are sizzling through
I'm wondering.
Coming at them. Coming out. And with third, fourth ball, one of his soldiers is decapitated. In order to inspire them, Prescott jumps up onto his battlements and waves his sword and says, you know, get me next, inspires his men to continue on. They build what was called the breastwork to the east, and then another general sees a gap on all the way to the edge of the Mystic River, and they form the rail fence, and then finally John Stark of New Hampshire arrives just as the battle is about to break out, and he realizes that the British could get behind their lines along the beach on the Mystic River. And he really saved the day because he at the last minute, he ordered his men to build a stone wall. And it was there that Howe had hoped to sneak in, his infantrymen, come around and attack the Patriots in flank. But instead of having the door wide open, it had been shut by Stark, and more than 100 people would die, British soldiers die in a matter of minutes.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I must say, one has to wonder about the communication both before and after the battle going on between London and Boston. What was that like? How quickly did those messages transmit? And what were they?
Well, you know, in this digital age, I think it's kind of amazing to discover that to get word back to England took at least a month, and And then it usually took Parliament and the ministry some time to come up with a response, let's say another month. And then it was another month to get it back. And so a three-month lag was typical. And this meant that once relations between the colonies and Britain started to go downhill, it was the Atlantic Ocean that almost ensured that Britain was going to lose these colonies. There are 3,000 miles between them. And with this kind of communication gap, there was no way that the British ministry was going to be able to coordinate its forces in a way that could keep up with the speed of which things were unfolding in the colonies.
How many British soldiers were left after the battle was over?
By this time, their army was up approaching 8,000 people.
Oh, my.
And so they still had a very large force. And they would, and by this point, after the battle, it then moves into a siege. And they would continue to reinforce their army until it approached about 9,000. And so here you had Boston. Most of the Patriots had left, only about 3,000 loyalists and refugees, but 9,000 soldiers. And so this city had been turned inside out. It was now a city under siege, surrounded by Patriots. And so it makes for a fascinating kind of microcosm of what can happen when a people in revolution have to contend with the army that comes in to set things right.
How did they carry on their lives?
It was completely disruptive. In fact, what you saw, and it's really amazing to see how quickly the Provincial Congress, which was what the Patriots came up with to just manage themselves, responded. And they would assign certain number of refugees per town outside Boston. And so you saw all of Massachusetts cooperating on a grand scale in terms of dealing with this incredible turmoil created by what was going on at Lexington and Concord and then Bunker Hill.
How did those residents get food, for example? Where was it coming from?
Well, a lot of it was coming from the farms in surrounding Massachusetts, but also Connecticut. You see all of the colonies kicking in. Even before violence broke out, you had Charleston, South Carolina, sending up rice. You had future General Putnam coming up with more than 100 sheep from his farm in Connecticut. It really brought out the best in what would become America.
But weren't the British sort of making sure that they controlled how it got doled out?
Yeah, it's interesting. What happened was, as the Patriots were flushed from Boston, the Brits there in the city were surrounded, and so they were without access to all of this food. It came, but luckily they had the British Navy, and that was their lifeline.
Bunker Hill, a city, a siege, a revolution. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Syria and the tough choices facing America with C.J. Chivers of the New York Times. He's been in Syria covering the civil war and has spent time with rebel forces there. Join us.
And welcome back. If you've just joined us, historian and author Nathaniel Philbrick is with me. He's written a book about Bunker Hill. He titles it exactly that, subtitled A City, A Siege, A Revolution. He says Boston is really the hero of this book. And when you think about these people in Boston watching this battle from the rooftops, you see the same thing playing out today on television after this horrendous explosion.
Oh, I mean, it reminded me that the horror, a spectator event that is just so terrifying and unknowable, and yet we're all watching it, was something that was unfolding in 1775, where people were up there with their kids beside them watching the fate of the English-speaking world be determined. And, it's there. A community under stress is something that forges bonds, that creates memories that will never be lost.
All right, let's go. Open the phones to Dan in Leesburg, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Thank you for accepting the call.
Sure.
In teaching history for 33 years, it's a Breed's Hill.
Yeah, he's already said exactly that.
Oh.
You didn't hear the earlier part of the program.
No, I did not.
Okay.
No, it's the confusion that will always be attached to this battle, and it began with a confusion, and it will always cause confusion, I think, among people learning history.
So how did that confusion actually begin and take hold?
Well, it was compounded by the fact that the British would then make a map that got that confused. It was supposed to be Bunker Hill. And they would stick with the name, even though that did not really reflect the reality.
It's a little more resonant, isn't it? Bunker Hill.
Yeah, and it's interesting how that might have had something to do with it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And let's go now to Milton, Florida. Good morning, Kirk.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
I had a couple of questions. One having to do with how well was John Stark followed orders, and the other one was had to do with Samuel Herrick and what was his involvement in the battle.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I can help you with the Herrick question, but John Stark was an irascible leader of men, that his men loved him, but he refused to play the political game. And so the legislature in New Hampshire was frustrated by the fact that, he wouldn't kowtow in the way that they felt was required to get a commission. And so he was always kind of embattled with the higher ups. But when it came to actually on the field getting it done, there was probably no one in the American Army that was a better fighter.
What's, Kirk, what's your understanding of Samuel Herrick?
I believe it was the second-in-command to John Stark. And when John Stark would become so enraged with the orders coming from above, perhaps it was Samuel Herrick that would take command.
I can't vouch for that. There are a lot of people who on the record describing Stark's emotions, and clearly he brought a lot into it. But what's interesting about the Battle of Bunker Hill is it was not just one person. William Prescott was there at the redoubt. There was Stark at the stone wall, and there were others at the rail fence. And it was a collaborative effort, and it was spontaneous, and that's what made it so hard for the British. Just when they thought they knew what they were up against, another fence or a breastwork would be built. And I think it's a wonderful metaphor for kind of America, where, we don't necessarily have a plan going into it, but with a little cooperative panic, things can happen. And that's really, I think, what made the Battle of Bunker Hill go as well as it did.
Here's
for the Americans.
Here's an email from Peter, who says, we're calling them patriots today. Wouldn't it be more correct to call them rebels who became patriots after they won our independence?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It's sort of like when I did Mayflower. What do you call the Pilgrims? Well, the Pilgrims is not necessarily the descriptor you'd like, but there's nothing really much better. The fact of the matter is the British referred to them as rebels and considered them rebels. And to become a patriot, you have to be loyal to a cause, and the cause that wins ends up being the one that continues on.
And you write that several weeks after the battle at Breed's Hill, George Washington arrives And you describe him in a rather interesting way, not sort of the George Washington we all think of as so elegant and commanding.
Well, it was a great relief to me to realize that Washington did not step out of the womb as the passive statue that stares at us from the dollar bill, that he was a man and a very passionate man, a very capable man who could was put in a very difficult situation after the Battle of Bunker Hill. He arrives a couple of weeks later, and he's from Virginia, grew up in a very different kind of environment. And here are a bunch of New Englanders, very dirty, undisciplined, and he was appalled by them. And he didn't know what he was going to do with them. They had a fighting reputation, but he didn't necessarily think that they deserved it. And he didn't had an appalling lack of gunpowder. And so he was intent that he had to get this done quickly. Otherwise, he might lose the opportunity of dealing with the British. So he wanted to attack the city of Boston, which would have been probably a disaster because of the lack of gunpowder and the fact that the British soldiers were so well dug into the city. And so what that would have done is basically reverse the advantage they had at Bunker Hill would work against them if they attacked
the
city.
Who talked him out of it?
He had his Council of War, a group of generals that, and the Continental Congress had made sure that any major decision was made, it had to be with the approval of his Council of War. And so they voted him down every time. But I think, you got to give Washington credit because he was injecting life into this. He made it clear that he wasn't going to just sit there and allow this to be a stalemate on if he had his druthers. And I think it injected an element of drive that the army desperately needed after the trauma of Bunker Hill.
So what does he do next after the Continental Congress turns him down?
Well, it turns into this siege that goes on throughout the fall of 1775 into the winter of 1776. And by this time, thoughts of independence are becoming rampant among the generals of his own army. Tom Paine's famous pamphlet is written, and the ground begins to move underneath everyone's feet. And Washington is pushing to get the British out. And the irony is that after the Battle of Bunker Hill, the British government had decided if we're going to fight this war, and we now know it's a war, Boston is not the place to do it. We need to pull the troops out and launch an invasion somewhere else to the south. It would end up being New York. And so the British had already decided to evacuate. Washington had no way of knowing this. And so in his determination to attack, it's interesting. If you take the perspective of Boston, the biggest threat during the siege would come not from the British, but from Washington. And eventually, however, they would get the artillery they needed from Fort Ticonderoga and a heroic adventure launched by Henry Knox, a former bookseller who, with his brother and a lot of help, would drag tons of armaments down from Fort Ticonderoga over the snow. And with these cannons up on a fort on Dorchester Heights overlooking Boston, Washington's army would force Howe, who now had taken over from Gage as the leader of the British forces, to evacuate Boston on April 17th. And so thus ended a siege that had been prepared for by the Battle of Bunker Hill, and Boston was once again, Bostonians were once again allowed to return.
Here's what I don't understand. The British were actually characterizing Bostonians as thugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, they thought they were the worst of the worst and undisciplined and dirty and all the rest. How did the people of Boston become so different from what we think of as the elegant, genteel people of Virginia? Didn't they all come from the same place.
They all came from England, but they came with very different cultural ways. The Puritans, when they originally arrived in the 1620s and 30s, instilled town meetings, which were basically democratic, where, you know, everyone could contribute to the conversation. And so these New Englanders were used to having a say in what was going on. And you saw it in the provincial army, where they would, their officer would tell them, well, this is what we're going to do. And they said, no, we're not. We're going to talk about this. And you see it time and time again. And this was the source of a lot of Washington's frustrations.
Okay, now tell me about the people of, say, Virginia. What were they like?
Washington came from an entirely different background. You know, he had a plantation where he had hundreds of slaves. It was very organized in terms of it was his world, and there was just a whole different kind of approach to the class system and
different mentality.
And you can see it in the accounts of officers who come up from Virginia and Maryland, saying, you know, they just cannot believe these New Englanders. In terms of, there's just no sense of the proper way people should be ordered in terms of society.
And here is John Adams among the people there in Massachusetts, beginning to send out these pamphlets, beginning to get the news out and spreading the word, perhaps against the rules of the British government.
Yeah, and it was actually John's cousin Samuel Adams.
Samuel Adams, with a committee
of correspondence. And it was this, I think, in many ways, was the key to what would become a revolution. And it was finding a way to communicate, to finding a way to get your message out that was not being tampered with by the royal government. And so it was with this, the committees of correspondence, that Samuel Adams really lay the groundwork for a revolution.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Falls Church, Virginia. Good morning, Whitney.
Hi, yeah. I'm just so enjoying this conversation. I like to say I have dual citizenship because I was raised in Massachusetts and I live in Virginia. And so it's so funny you were just making those final comments. One thing that when you're in fourth grade, I think it is, wherever you are in the U.S., you learn about your state. And when I was growing up in Massachusetts, it was all about U.S. history as one of the little guy taking over. It was guerrilla warfare. It was scrappy revolutionaries. And then my kids now in Virginia are getting a very different view, like you were just describing. So my comment is, you know, in this very divided America of today, I'm just wondering how what you're describing as Breed's Hill, you know, how that would play in Peoria. Because I'm, you know, that kind of, when I went to UVA, it was like I was butting heads constantly with people who thought in terms of might is right and America is big and we have to stay powerful. And my conscience was always like, no, that's not how revolutionaries are born. That's not how our country was born. And you have to look at the world differently where there are revolutions, because frankly, that's where we were born.
So, yeah. Well, you raise some great points, and you know the how divided America was and how divided America is I think the essential part of being an American, and it's the amazing thing that we can contain this variety of sentiment and somehow operate on the same page. You know, the battle at Breed's Hill that became the Battle of Bunker Hill was a wake-up call to everyone. Are we in this together, or do we do it on our own? And suddenly you had Virginians and people from Maryland, you know, all up there in Boston. And people had to get out of their heads. One of their previous mindsets. Bostonians had this tradition of Pope Night in November, where it was basically an anti-Catholic ceremony, loosely based on Guy Fawkes Day. And George Washington, when he realized that many of his soldiers were going to celebrate this in November of 1775, passed a regulation that, no, we will not celebrate this, because there were hopes at this point that they would get the French Canadians in on their sides who were Catholics. And he said, you know, the basically is we cannot have this kind of attitude given the circumstances under which we are in. And I think that is the kernel of what will become America, and that there you have to begin to see things out of your own little regional view and recognize that there are other points of view if it's going to happen in a constructive way.
So what parallels do you draw between what happened then and what's happening now in the Middle East?
Well, you know, it was interesting. When I began working on this book, as Arab Spring was coming about, and, you know, you're in the archives, you're writing in your desk, trying to channel the past, but the present is all around. Revolutions, there's a dynamic to a revolution that hasn't really changed all that much in terms of how you bring a country down, how you use violence to get regime change. The problem is, what do you do after you do the revolution? And that's the rub.
Did we do it right?
I think we've done it about as well as anyone has.
Nathaniel Philbrick, historian, author. His new book is titled Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. How wonderful to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, Diane.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from